I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Evening and welcome to the still online London Review Bookshop. I'm Sam Kitchen-Smith, the LRB's Head of Special Projects, and I'm delighted to introduce tonight's speakers, Paul Gilroy, Professor of Humanities at UCL, author of foundational books including There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack and Darker Than Blue, Holberg Prize laureate, and according to a recent Guardian piece, the most vital guide to our age of crisis, and Adam Schatz, the LRB's US editor, author of recent LRB pieces you'll no doubt have read on Edward Said and the Algerian War, and a forthcoming book about Fanon. They'll be discussing William Gardner Smith's 1963 novel, The Stone Face, recently reissued by New York Review Books, with a new introduction by Adam, which you can buy from the bookshop using the link lrb.me/stone. Over to you, Adam.
Thanks so much, Sam, and it's great to be here with you, Paul.
Yeah, I'm so excited that this book has come back into print. It really is a dream come true for me.
Well, I mean, you were one of the first people I knew of to write about the book. And a couple of days ago, you sent me an article that William Gardner Smith published in Ebony about Richard Wright. Gardner Smith was a journalist, besides being a novelist, and came to Paris in the early 50s and befriended Wright. And there's a passage in that interview that really struck me. Wright is quoted saying, "The break from the United States was more than a geographical change. It was a break with my former attitudes as a Negro and a communist, an attempt to think over and redefine my attitudes and my thinking. I was trying to grapple with the big problem, the problem and meaning of Western civilization as a whole, and the relation of Negroes and other minority groups to it." Now, Wright was not the only person to do that. I mean, as you've known in books like The Black Atlantic and Between Camps, many thinkers of the Black Atlantic were trying to do the same thing. Fanon, W.E.B. Du Bois. And of course, Gardner Smith fits into this story because of this novel, and also because of his first novel, Last of the Conquerors, published when he was 22 years old, just out of the army. He'd been in Germany. And so I wanted to start, Paul, by asking you how it is you came to discover The Stone Face, which, you know, was beyond obscure. It was, you know, by the time you stumbled upon it, it was virtually unknown except to people who were really specialists in African-American literature.
Mm. Well, I mean, obviously, the piece you mentioned from Ebony in 1953, Wright's sort of pompous claim is sort of somewhat undermined by the beautiful photograph of the Wrights sitting down for their six-course evening meal with their children and being served by one of their two, we're told, French maids, who's providing this extraordinary feast, you know, at a time when rationing and the war and the memory of all of that, the culture of food and deprivation is still a feature of everyday life for so many people. I think I learned about William Gardner Smith as a novelist from Bill French, who used to run the old University Place bookstore in Manhattan. And that was a place where people used to buy books, black books that chronicled the shop itself, with its sort of decaying roof and broken window frames, was a kind of incredible archive of a black intellectual life. And I think it was Bill who had mentioned that he was more than a journalist. When I was doing Black Atlantic, I found that piece and I'd mentioned it. Bill said, well, you know, he was a novelist. And Michael Denning, another colleague and a friend, had told me about Last of the Conquerors. So I got that first. And I've been thinking about the liberation of European concentration camps by African-American and Japanese-American soldiers who wrote interesting things. I think I'd come across a film by Bill Miles and Nina Rosenblum called Liberators. And I've been in the Fortune of Archive at Yale looking at the video recordings of Jewish camp inmates who had been liberated by African-American soldiers. And I think, you know, Tadeusz Borowski, the Polish writer, not Jewish, communist writer, had the same experience. One of his most extraordinary short stories is about that encounter.
This is the author of The Next to the Gas Chambers.
Yes, this way to the gas, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Well, I guess I was really interested in the shame involved, and that's where I was. And then I found Last of the Conquerors, you know, in its one of its pulp fiction incarnations of the particularly kind of lurid and how shocking in some ways kind of cover. And there was this sort of immensely serious and interesting attempt to place these histories of horror, of brutality, of cruelty in some sort of moral and literary, cultural, historical relation with one another. It was the most extraordinary thing. And it was that encounter that led me to Gardner Smith's life and to this book, The Stone Face, which really develops the themes and questions that are coming out of Last of the Conquerors in a much more sustained and thoughtful way. And I was kind of astonished by it. I think there's some, you know, literary limitations or whatever, but I was just so happy to discover this, that there was such a sort of complete pursuit of these questions at such a difficult time to be asking questions about, you know,
October 17th
in Paris, this extraordinary pogrom, where, you know, people have been writing about Papon's trial. I think Alan Finkielkraut and others have been writing about Papon's trial. But I certainly didn't know that there was an African-American writer who was prepared to take possession of those events, to use them to complicate and trouble the understanding of that sort of history of 20th century horror. And so it was a revelation. And the more I learned about Gardner Smith, the more excited I was. And of course, the dimensions and the meaning of the horror of those events in Paris as we approach the 60th anniversary is not something that can be said to have been completely assimilated, although I understand that this book, The Stone Face, has finally now been published in French. So it'll be interesting to see what that was. So when I was writing Between Camps, I had seen some of the things in Libération. NOD had gone and interviewed survivors. From the
you're talking about the journalist and historian Jean-Luc Hénaudy,
yes,
wrote this book called The Battle of Paris, la Bataille de Paris, about the which was a very important book about the October events.
Yeah, and so I was really again astonished by the testimony of the survivors of that event, and it just seemed so important to be able to make a slightly different map of this period in which events that were being conducted in Paris, which were so connected both to the history of Europe that was proximate and to the history of the French Empire at that time, and to show the kind of precision and thoughtfulness with which a Black writer would enter that very difficult territory.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, although the book is you know, as I think you suggested, didactic in some ways. It's also very evocative of that period, the beginning of the new wave, the cafe scenes, jazz. Mm. Gardner Smith was a journalist, and he noticed a lot. So it is a novel that is full of Parisian life and full of affection for Paris, even as it carries out a kind of dismantling of some of France's foundational myths, above all the myth of colorblind France.
Yeah, I think it captures the delicacy of that in the same way that he does in his earlier book, in the Berlin book, because he's got a range of different African-American voices who are all responding at different intensities, at different frequencies, to the promise and the problems involved in their French dwelling, to the political choices and conflicts that arise within that community, which is very much in the sort of cutting edge of Cold War politics. I've never really been able to understand exactly who's spying on who when we go to the archive to think about it. And of course, that story is still incomplete, I think, because, you know, one person who denied for many years and won a lawsuit over the fact that they'd been accused of being a CIA agent seems to have been inadvertently outed as a CIA agent by President Trump quite recently.
You're referring to Richard Gibson, I think.
I am, yes. I was just a little bit tentative because I wasn't sure what, I mean, given the history of litigation in that story, you know, I wasn't sure how moribund that had become after the Trump administration disclosed that he was, in fact, in the pay of the CIA in a later period. So the density with which the Cold War is being played out in these rooms, in these cafes, in these restaurants, in these clubs, you know, is another rather forbidding element in the story that Gardner Smith kind of alludes to here.
I mean, the Cold War, of course, had been the defining obsession and preoccupation of the black expatriate or exile scene around the Café Monaco and the Café de Tournon, where Richard Wright was, you know, the king. Of course, Chester Himes was there. Baldwin passed through it in the late 1940s and wrote his famous critiques of Richard Wright's work. And there were many others. Ollie Harrington, the famous black cartoonist. Who is, I think, the character Babe in this novel, and who eventually got so freaked out by the atmosphere of Cold War paranoia that he took refuge in East Germany and spent his last days in East Berlin. I think he went there in 1961. Yeah. So the Cold War, of course, is present in this novel. And there's, in fact, a very entertaining monologue about Khrushchev being seen as a black man by American right-wing anti-communists. And yet at the same time, you feel the presence and emergence of a new set of political questions around the rise of what was then known as the Third World, around national liberation movements, Algeria, the murder of Patrice Lumumba into this. Yeah. Also in quite a striking way, because the stone face, you know, originally is an allusion to the face of anti-black hatred in the United States. But in the course of this novel, the stone face comes to allude to the Nazis in the camps, to French police killing Algerian demonstrators, and even, he says at one point, to the Congolese who murdered Patrice Lumumba. It's becoming a metaphor of brutality and murder.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very striking passage. It precedes the bit that I want to read later on. I think there's another thread that's important here too. You've talked about the Cold War, you've talked about the unfolding wars of decolonization as a feature of that, but also as a separate phenomenon that's unfolding during this period. Let's remember that in the 17th of October, when the Algerians who'd been rounded up and placed in the stadium for initial detention and triage, or whatever the correct word is, you know, I mean, 3 days later, that space was being used for a concert by Ray Charles.
Indeed.
And if you look at Ray Charles' autobiography, Brother Ray, he says how freaked out he was to be in Paris because he knew about the Algerian wars in full blast and bombs are exploding all over town. But the Algerians had sent a note to my promoter saying there'd be no bombings on my route from my hotel to the concert. Tell Brother Ray not to worry, they said, and I didn't, says Rachel. So there's another layer, which is that the kind of immediate cleaning up aesthetically, culturally, that was being done by African Americans in the context of post-war Europe is actually entering a new phase, and actually the figure of Ray Charles is sort of pivotal in that larger cultural engagement with what do we call it, the not soft power, something like African American culture on its governmental travels during the period.
Sure. When you had all those jazz ambassadors, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, others. I mean, I want to underline how extraordinary it is that Gardner Smith captures the events of October 17 in this novel, and does so with, I mean, amazing repertorial accuracy. I mean, he must have been a witness because Well, I mean, I became interested in this novel while I was doing a bit of research a decade or so ago about October 17 and reading Jean-Luc Einaudi and others. And I was curious what kind of fictional representations there were of the massacre. Obviously, there was Michael Haneke's film Cachet, which is about the repressed memory of October 17. There was a very interesting film, a documentary, almost a Chris Marker-like documentary called Octobre à Paris, October in Paris, made by Jacques Panigel and released in early 1962. And that grew out of work among left-wing militants who wanted to keep alive the memory of October 61. But the first novel to deal with this subject in French was Didier Deneng's book, Meurtre pour Mémoire, Murder in Memoriam, which wasn't published until the mid-1980s. It was just really exceptional that Gardner Smith even wrote about it. And it's striking that he refers to it taking place on October 1st, 1961, not October 17. I mean, perhaps it was just a careless error or a typo, or maybe this was his effort to conceal what he was writing about. In any case, it was the only one of his books that was not translated into French in his lifetime. I mean, Gardner Smith was very much a part of French life. In some ways, he was more a part of French media life than other writers living in Paris at the time, because he was with Agence France-Presse, he was on TV, he was a representative of Black American fiction, often spoke about Black American politics, and yet this one novel did not appear. And I think that's quite remarkable. So for him to have written about this was in some ways it was a very gutsy act.
Yes. Yes, he seems to have been incredibly brave to do this. Although, again, in a way, I don't think he could have helped himself, because he's not, in a sense, he's not a reporter. He's doing this in a sense for his own benefit and for the enrichment of the moral imagination of African Americans and diasporic Africans who, you know, have just been gathering in Paris for the first couple of times in the conferences of 56 and 59. I haven't checked whether he attended those events, but I mean, I'm sure he must have been implicated in the sort of intellectual swirl around them. And again, I think these are events, although selections from both were published in Présence Africaine, these are not events that are part of the kind of common history of African diasporic cultural and political life, and they really should be, you know, because the presentations made controversially by Wright and Fanon, but many others with different political takes and different cultural proclivities, you know, are still an extraordinary record of the development of these things in the 20th century. I mean, Sinclair Drake, who attended this and one, I think, speaks of this period as the absolute peak moment of this Pan-African project of the 20th century. And it's clear that Gardner Smith is someone who understands that importance and wants to kind of augment it by suggesting ways in which we can see these things not as discrete histories, but as things that are, you know, empirically and morally connected to one another. Yes, the detail of that final section of the book where he's processing the events themselves is preceded by his epiphany that really this face that he keeps encountering is this universal human phenomenon.
Now, they're connecting these histories, and yet they're also, I mean, in some ways, they also collide and require tough choices. You mentioned Baldwin earlier. You mentioned the 1956 Présence Africaine conference, and he of course, reported on that. But, you know, and it's quite an interesting piece, because at that time, Baldwin was very insistent on his Americanness and what differentiated him from the Africans and West Indians that he heard. And he's quite skeptical in that essay. And it's only later that he begins to really grapple with what connects him to people in the in colonial countries and French subjects and so on. But not in 56. And you know, Gardner Smith's character, Simeon Brown, has to make some difficult choices. And, you know, when he's confronted by the Algerian question, there's an Algerian and, you know, he gets into a scuffle early in the novel with a man who turns out to be Algerian. In a scene that strikes Simeon as utterly surreal, the police side with him, not with the Algerian. The Algerian is tossed into the back of a police wagon and driven off, and he's benefiting from a kind of special status, almost from a kind of white privilege in France as a Black American. Yeah. And his Black American friends at the cafes, like Babe and various writers, are very discouraging when he talks about the Algerians and compares their situation to that of Black people in American cities. They don't want to get involved. They don't want to get mixed up. I mean, they have very good reasons, of course. They don't want to be expelled from France. But in order to solidarize with these Algerians, he has to disaffiliate from his quote-unquote brothers. And yeah. and it's a real ethical quandary in the novel, and it provides the novel with its dramatic point of tension, I think.
Yeah, I think he's sort of, if I'm right, and I mean, there's only that one rather inadequate biography of him available that I know of anyway. And I suppose I think because he'd already had his passport confiscated, I think maybe that may have enabled him to be bolder.
His condition of statelessness, because he made one trip to East Berlin.
Germany, yes. So maybe that helps to kind of account for it. But every opportunity he has to take the easy, to make the easy road, to take the easy choice, he declines it, you know. And there must be something pushing that. There must be something driving that that's interesting, because it's a didactic book aesthetically, but I don't think it's politically didactic, because he doesn't really know where this relationship with Algeria, where this relationship with the violence of the French colonial enterprise come home into policing, not into war, but into policing, into torture. I mean, the harrowing scene where the Algerian women recount the nature of the sexual tortures practiced upon them by the French counterinsurgency. You know, this is all extremely difficult and extremely important, actually, for us today when we return to try and read this book and find what can be useful in it in some, you know, different circumstances, but ones which in their own ways repeat some of the hard questions that Gardner Smith seems to want us to.
I want to pause for a moment to talk about that scene with the two Algerian women, because with Jamila and Latifa, whom he's brought to meet by his friend Ahmed, who's a young Kabyle intellectual who describes himself as a bourgeois intellectual and ends up going to join the Maquis in Algeria. It's an amazing scene, not least because the account of the torture is so graphic and so close to what would only become much later known about French practices of torture. There had been, of course, Henri Alleg's book, The Question, which was suppressed. Fanon had written about the tortures of Algerians in The Wretched of the Earth. Pierre Vidal-Naquet had written about torture and torture in the Republic. And yet, not much was known particularly about the torture, the sexual torture of women, the rape of women, with broken bottles, for example, which is described in this book. It's a shocking scene, and he writes about the fact that the women do not want to be in the room when that story is being recounted, which I think also touches upon the question of the memory of torture in Algeria, where very little was said about that subject for years because of the shame.
Yeah, I mean, this is a number of places in the book where Gardner Smith, you know, seems to be someone who's struggling to integrate his intuitions about the place of gender and gendered violence, of male violence, in the formation and reproduction of this face and the mentalities and institutions that foster it and use it in police, in war, in the maintenance maintenance of segregated dwelling in US cities and the other examples that he gives. And I think there are a number of places in the book where that erupts into the text. And I mean, I feel this is maybe one element in the book which is not as fully realized as we might want it to be, but I do think it's there, and it's incredibly important to see that there, that his mind is open to these things, and he's in a way unable to resolve what that strand of cruelty, of violence, what those habits bring to his wider understanding of the processes that are unfolding around him.
Because there is a somewhat guilty, almost Freudian confession at the beginning of the novel, where Simeon Brown, the protagonist, is reflecting on his own participation in sexual violence as an adolescent, and it's a very strange anecdote, because it's there and it's not really commented upon, and we don't exactly know what the connection is to the stone face and the rest of the novel, but we know that this continues to burden him on some level.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, I've taught this book a few times, and I've always struggled with that section of it. Although I suppose I began to think, first of all, the discourse of African American family pathology hadn't yet been articulated from within the center of the U.S. government, and a book which is so focused, so engaged with the question of what, after all, is it to be a man in opposition to these processes of racialization, it seems that he isn't content with looking at the acquisition of that thwarted masculinity only in relation to the oppressors. You know, there is a sort of Fanonian strand of this that relates to gender relations, which is, I suppose, actually, to be generous to him, involves a stronger sense of the entanglement of these of dimensions. And in terms of Simeon's own character in the novel, it's very striking, I think, that Gardner Smith says something like, well, to the other boys, it wasn't rape, but to Simeon, it was rape.
This was
rape for Simeon. And I think what we've been given there is some kind of attunement to the particular sensibilities of Simeon. I'm trying to remember whether he's been blinded at that point. I don't think he has been. Certainly, I mean, there are obvious things to say about the blinding and the forms of sight which are acquired in the loss of that eye. But there is an attempt here to tell us at that very early point, at that adolescent point, that we're dealing with somebody who's a different kind of man, mm-hmm. who recoils in some way from mm-hmm. this violence and from the incorporation of these women and girls into their own sort of immiseration that he describes.
Right, and we do know that Gardner Smith himself, as a young man in Philadelphia, was brutalized in a police station when I think he was 14 or 15 years old.
He was
very familiar with that kind of violence.
Yeah. Well, the other novel, South Street, has got some material that relates to that, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things this novel also does very well is to put into question the idea that Black writers in Paris at that time could be described as Black expatriates rather than Black exiles. There's a very strong strain of trauma that runs through this novel, especially in the flashbacks, where he is reflecting on his upbringing in Philadelphia, not in the South, but in the North. Mm-hmm. And at one point, he's asked by Babe why he's come to Paris, and Babe is a very jovial kind of bon viveur, and he says, "Well, I came to Paris because if I hadn't left, I might have ended up killing someone."
Yeah.
I think it also suggests that exile can result in an expansion of the imagination and of the imagination of solidarity, rather than a kind of inert and sterile homesickness, which has been often, I think, the accusation against writers like Richard Wright, who went to Paris, that somehow they went there and they they lost their gift. They were uprooted, and the work that they produced was no longer of value. And I think that, you know, this novel, among others, urges us to rethink that complacent assumption.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a moment early on, isn't there, where Babe refers to Simeon as a refugee.
And the first part of the novel is the fugitive.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think we, you know, there is a, as you know, I'm sure, you know, within the sort of vogue for cultural and critical theory among African Americans currently, a great deal of attention given to the notion of fugitivity as a conceptual apparatus to interpret all kinds of cultural work. But I think the idea of refugees here, I mean, this is a very early pronouncement about the refugee status of African American, you know, cultural workers on the road. And I guess I was very struck by that. I've always been very struck by that, you know, in teaching this particular book.
You know, another thing that really strikes me about the Stone Face is the treatment of the Jewish question and anti-Semitism. Simeon Brown becomes involved with a Polish Jewish survivor, Maria, who is losing her sight and who aspires to become an actress. I think she's a somewhat problematic character, one of the weaker characters. But there's this, one of the most intense scenes in the novel takes place at a cafe during a conversation with Simeon, Maria, and some of his Algerian friends. And one of his Algerian friends makes an anti-Semitic remark, and Maria says, "Well, you know, you're looking at a dirty Jew." And another of his Algerian friends, then unleashes this monologue, which is about his feelings of betrayal by Algerian Jews who had supported the French colonial presence. There are, of course, allusions also to the Arab-Israeli conflict, and one has a sense that these two historic victims of the West, the Arabs and the Jews, are now on a kind of collision course. And Gardner Smith doesn't resolve that, to his credit. I mean, I don't think he's not trying to make this easier for us. He's depicting a dilemma and a predicament that, you know, is still with us today.
Yeah, I mean, he's not comfortable with Manichaean judgments. And I think that to be able to do what much 20th century theorizing about the nature of racial power and racial violence does, and to link the history of anti-Semitism and the sort of effective potency of anti-Semitism, and show that they're not confined only to those we most readily imagine as the oppressors of Jews, but that actually there are all kinds of ways in which anti-Semitism can't be confined like that, is one thing. And then to be able to, as he insists, really, he's using a concept of racism, I suppose, implicitly, which joins those histories together as they are joined together. And they're also separated, but here they are joined together and they are seen to inform one another. You know, that we find a moment like this in many other texts of the period. And sometimes it's more problematic than it seems to be for Gardner Smith. One thinks of Fanon's, you know, early description of anti-Semitism as a kind of family quarrel among whites, although that's, of course, not the only thing he says. Or I think of Césaire's view of the relationship between anti-black racism and anti-Semitism in Discourse on Colonialism.
Right. So these things... And the notion that the Negrophobe is almost inevitably an anti-Semite.
So we've got... These things, I imagine, are being kind of constantly thought through and argued over and argued about. And I think it's really bold for a book that aligns so dramatically with the Algerian force of anti-colonial resistance against French power to not luxuriate in the idea that this is the one sort of clean, perfect, sacred struggle that we can locate upon. But those problems and processes are alive in the center of that, as they must be, because they have to be worked through. So we're not given an easy opportunity to fantasize about the utter nobility of this.
No one is a pure victim. Even Maria, who is a survivor, is someone who is desperate to kind of flee into whiteness.
That's true. No, I agree, and I applaud that about the book. And it's also the case that in doing this and in seeking to articulate together African-American history and struggles inside the United States with a diasporic perspective and what we think of as an anti-colonial or decolonial perspective, it's not as though the history of African-American resistance and African-American struggle is kind of downplayed or muted or pushed to the back. I think there's a real attempt to braid these things together in a way that is extremely unusual. So we've got the old character who talks about slave revolts and Demalvesian Gabriel's rebellion, Nat Turner, and so on, as well as the unfolding civil rights struggle. So I think I've been trying, it's very hard to talk about a book without absolutely spoiling it for people who haven't looked at it. You're perhaps more practiced at that than I am. I just feel it's terribly important to applaud the attempt to bring these things together.
You did raise a question about the novel that I wanted to ask you again about. I believe it was in Between Camps, the book that is called right. Against Race in the States. Without giving too much away about the plot, originally Gardner Smith had his protagonist go to Africa, and Gardner Smith, of course, after publishing. Yeah. Went to Ghana. He was in Ghana for a couple of years with his family, and his wife at the time had their son there, and he socialized with Malcolm X and William Mayfield and Maya Angelou and got to know Kwame Nkrumah. And yet Simeon Brown does not go to Africa. Mm. And in your book, you suggested that there was something a bit half-hearted. That Gardner Smith had retreated from this radical vision of solidarity with a vision of kind of vision of homecoming, and I'm wondering, do you still feel that to be the case? Because at the same time, Gardner Smith does refer to Black Americans as Americans Algerians, so he is still linking those histories and those conditions. Did you still feel that Gardner Smith failed to go all the way?
I think that if you really believe that the universal nature of these horrors and these forms of violence and cruelty and infrahumanity can't be contained with any particular empirical manifestation of them, then it's really unfair to suggest that you should prioritize their undoing in your place of origin. And I think, so I wouldn't feel so strongly about that now. And I think there's been some material emerging about the role of the agents and the editors in changing a number of these, not just Gardner Smith's own manuscripts.
Richard Wright,
particularly, notably a victim of this process. And that's always been strange to me. I mean, we know, I suppose, thanks to Frances Stoner Saunders and the work she did on the kind of cultural Cold War, we have a very strong version of this in relation to certain publications and authors and cultural workers. But what we don't really have is a version of that that speaks to the process of decolonization and the management of publications by African-American and other Black writers. And I do wonder about the role. I mean, you mentioned Wright, but of course, Asner and the others who were involved in managing Wright's career were particularly, I think, damaging. Although the travel books that he produced out of their refusal to publish his fiction are an amazing resource and full of insights to look at the period we've been talking about. But I do wonder about the role of agents and publishers and editors in massaging and sculpting a particular repertory of of minor voices, you know, in this period, as the category of writing by African Americans and other Black writers becomes something that can be sellable.
And I think that was probably particularly the case when Black writers like Richard Wright and in his book The Outsider or Gardner Smith decided they were not going to stay in their lane. They were going to explore subjects outside the United States, you know, outside the United States in a more philosophical or political dimension, that they weren't going to write classical protest novels about conditions in the States. And I think that there probably was more resistance.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, Savage Holiday is not my favorite book of Richard Wright's, but I think that in his case, you know, he resolves it in part through writing about white characters. And, you know, I mean, there are many.
As Baldwin did in Giovanni's Room.
As Baldwin did, exactly. So there are a number of things to be said about that as a kind of attempt to resolve these pressures too, I think.
Now, you said earlier that Gardner Smith, you know, is working here as a novelist, not as a reporter. But what's clear is that he was a very serious reporter. And what really, because, you know, what strikes me about this novel is just the sensitivity and nuance of his account of France at the time and his understanding of Algerian politics. We have Arab characters. We have Kabyle Berber characters. He writes with great insight about women and their hopes of the Algerian Revolution. I mean, the two women whom he meets say that thanks to the Algerian Revolution, they have succeeded in emancipating themselves. That was, of course, the hope. And Fanon wrote about that in Algeria Unveiled. That did not turn out to be the case after the war. But we have this, you know, this sense of the possibility and potential of that revolution as imagined by, you know, young people who rally to the ranks of the FLN. So it's quite a journalist. It's in a way, it's a journalistic achievement as well.
As well. Yeah. No, I can see that. And I think that is one of the things that makes it worth engaging with from our own historical predicament. It's not just a curiosity. I think that there's something that we might learn actually from allowing these complicating dynamics to once again ventilate some of the more confining aspects of critical perspectives that make histories of trauma and horror the exclusive property of particular castes of victims in ways that are incommunicable to others. So I don't know if you'd call that a reporter's work or a literary one, but the attempt to articulate and to communicate these things across cultural and linguistic and other historical lines that we've told repeatedly are impermeable or incorrigible is the achievement of this book for me.
I think there's a passage that you wanted to read from late in the novel.
Yeah, thank you. It comes just after his epiphany about the aching eye and the universal fusion of this stone face. And he's woken up in the midst of the Algerian crowd that has been herded into the sports ground for processing. Simeon was in a group of some 200 men and women who were seated in a corner of the room. A man next to Simeon smiled and spoke to him in Arabic. Simeon said in French, "I don't speak Arabic." "Are you African?" "No, American." The man pursed his lips and arched his brows in surprise. For a moment, he seemed skeptical. Then he said, "Good." They sat for hours on the damp, cold floor, changing positions frequently to relieve their aching muscles. From time to time, the women raised their voices in a shrill you-you wail again. Simeon thought of what Ahmed had told him, how he had never felt as happy as when he found himself with a guerrilla unit fighting against parachutists. Simeon understood now what Ahmed meant. At around 1 o'clock, the police came to them with pots of stiff, lukewarm mashed potato with ground meat mixed into it, which served as lunch. There were no plates or forks, and each man was served in his cupped hands. They all ate hungrily. A man in civilian clothes wove in and out among the prisoners, looking at the faces. He paused and frowned when he saw Simeon. He walked over to him. "Are you an Arab?" he asked. Simeon shook his head. The Algerians looked at him. "What are you, African?" Simeon hesitated a moment, then said, "American." Still frowning, the man turned and walked away. So I think I like these questions. I like these questions. I mean, you know, they're very familiar questions. What are you?
Who are you?
Yeah, that Simeon's, you know, body refuses to disclose the truths of its kind of racial positioning to the casual observer. You know, he has to be interrogated about it. This is also, I think, part of unsettling the character, of unsettling the habits of perception and repetition that keep the kind of racial world functioning.
Right, and it's very unsettling to him. I mean, I remember a scene in the book where he's walking with his friend Ahmed, and they pass by a police station, and Ahmed says, "Usually, I'm terrified passing a police station." You know, this is 1960, 61 in Paris, a period of kind of urban warfare, actually. Mm-hmm. The war had come to France, and, you know, the ratissage and police sweeps were very common. And he says, why aren't you frightened now? And Ahmed says, well, I'm here with you, you know, and I'm here with someone respectable. Mm-hmm. And he says, how does it feel to be respectable? And Simeon says, well, it feels very odd. He says, what does it feel like to have that kind of power, even odder? And this is not a position that Simeon ever imagined occupying, that of power, that of respectability, that of a kind of, you know, honorary whiteness in a way, yes. If we're using that language. And I think the question that it raises for Simeon and for Gardner Smith is, well, then what do I owe? Like, what are my ethical responsibilities in this position? Is it enough for me just to be here, having fled the terror of American racism? Can I just enjoy life as Maria counsels him to do? Can I just forget? And no, something in him doesn't allow him to forget. Maybe it's lodged in that memory that we described, that memory of the chase and of his own feelings that he had been complicit in the rape. Perhaps that he's somehow more sensitive than, I mean, maybe that's, you know, an indication, but he's someone who clearly can't accept simply being comfortable and being on the side of those, being on the side of domination. He's something in him rebels against that.
Yes, and I think there's, alongside the rape scene, or just after it, there's the voice of the ancestor, the paternal ancestor, who's custodian of the custodian repository of the memories of struggle and resistance that define the political life of African American communities in Simeon's memory. So they're those two traces really that guide us.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We have a few questions. We have a little bit of time. One of the questions is whether Gardner Smith would have been aware of the Battle of Algiers. This novel came out 3 years before the Battle of Algiers. Yeah. Although perhaps this is the moment to mention that, you know, this week we've lost Saadi Yassef, who was one of the leaders of the Battle of Algiers and then went on to co-write and star in the film made by Gilles Pontecorvo. And we also lost Melvin Van Peebles, who made a wonderful film in the mid-60s called Story of a Three-Day Pass, La Permission, which is a similarly disenchanted view of a Black American experience in Paris. But certainly Gardner Smith would have been aware of the Battle of Algiers when it came out and when it was banned in France. Another question is, someone would like to know more about the chase. Well, how would you classify the novel as a genre? Would you call this a protest novel? What do you think, Paul?
Well, that quarrel is a, this opens the door onto a very difficult set of questions. Adam, you're laughing because obviously, you know, whether Baldwin said he didn't get that right. So the idea that Richard Wright, in producing the figure of Bigger Thomas as a sort of savage predator, a sort of superhuman predator on white womanhood, you know, doesn't count as a protest novel. Native Son doesn't count as a protest novel. And of course, according to Baldwin, behind Native Son and its sort of sentimental architecture, which is kind of partially disguised by the kind of communist verbiage of the
Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yeah, stands the figure of Harriet Beecher Stowe, you know, wagging her finger at the world and praying, you know, in between her admonitions. So I would say by those criteria, this is not.
To me, it's more of a buildings roman. It's a coming into consciousness.
Yes. I absolutely agree with that, that this is about Simeon's development. It's a novel of development, buildings roman.
Another question, how would I, familiar with the ideas and theories of the Tunisian writer Albert Memmi, apply those to the views of the Jewish-Arab situation and these colonial conflicts explored in Gardner Smith, perhaps less dismissively than in the hastier analyses of Fanon and Césaire made of anti-Semitism? I actually want to stand up for Césaire and Fanon. I don't think that they were hasty in their discussions of anti-Semitism. In fact, Fanon's analysis of racism owed a great deal to Sartre's book, Anti-Semite and Jew. And I do think that that passage that you mentioned about the family quarrel, typically taken out of context, I think actually mm-hmm. thought quite deeply about anti-Semitism. And Césaire, took the issue very, very seriously as well, while noting, of course, that Europeans became indignant and outraged and, of course, and then guilty over the mass extermination of Jews, even though similar methods on a less industrial scale had been applied to people of color by the colonial empires. That's the argument that he was making in the discourse on colonialism. Memmi is a fascinating figure, Tunisian Jewish writer who wrote a very important book on colonialism, Portrait of the Colonizer, Portrait of the Colonized, and a masterly first novel, Pillar of Salt. I think that Memmi certainly shared a taste for paradox. And for the complex ways in which racial histories overlap and collide in a colonial situation. I don't think that his politics were the same as Gardner Smith's, but I think in sensibility there's perhaps a certain comparison to be made. I'm wondering what you think, Paul.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I was thinking as you began to talk about something slightly different, which has really got to do with the fact that Claude Lanzmann is sitting in the cafe as well, right, with them. And so the question of how one represents these horrors, what it is to seek to represent them, what forms literary, aesthetic, cultural, you know, what corresponds to creative, respectful representation of these horrors? How is that going to work in literature? And I think that there are things about this book which are attempts, preliminary attempts, but nonetheless stimulating and interesting attempts to respond to that question of how do we represent these things which are supposedly ineffable, sublime, which exceed language. How are we going to do that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the clunkiness of Simeon's blinding and his operations as a painter, which we learn so little about. I think that's here because the question of how these things can be communicated, how they should be represented, and what the ethics of those choices might add up to, things that Gardner Smith sort of identifies very, very early on in a way that I think is worth applauding.
Right, and I think this clunkiness too is not simply a reflection of his technical abilities. It's also a reflection of just the complexity of the subject matter and his determination mm-hmm. to be, you know, what Edward Said called contrapuntal, and to mm-hmm. set these histories beside each other, not to attempt to resolve them, but to remain very sensitive to each people's history of oppression. I mean, in a sense, Lanzmann is almost the opposite, because he mm-hmm. begins as someone who you know, is very alert to the anguish of the colonized. He visited Fanon in Tunis. And then essentially he developed a strangely Fanonian kind of Zionism in which the only case of oppression that mattered to him was the persecution of Jews. Other people ceased to matter to him. So he's almost, I think, a negative example.
No, that's true. And I mean, obviously, Amari's on that same path. But I think that they take different aesthetic, if that's the right word, or anti-aesthetic choices. That was the point that I was getting. It wasn't really a political point about Landsman, although, you know, he's in the room too. He's in the cafe.
You know, the last thing I wanted to ask you, Paul, has to do with the impact of World War II. You know, Gardner Smith felt that the experience of World War II was really critical to the kind of internationalist liberation consciousness of so many returning Black soldiers. And of course, this was also true for Algerians. But there is an Algerian character in this novel who said, look, I fought with the Free French. And then I came home to Algeria, and we were still living under colonialism. And of course, in 1945, on V-Day, Algerians held up the Algerian flag, and there were skirmishes, and tens of thousands of Algerians were murdered by the French in the massacres of Sétif and Guelma. So,
Well, and of course, the same thing's happening in Senegal too, isn't it? I mean, there's the camp at Tiaroye, you know, and the history that's kind of recovered by Semben Ousmane is also that same story. I forgot your question, though, Adam.
The way that the Second World War, I mean, Gardner Smith.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, the way that the Second World War results in this kind of internationalization of Black American political consciousness, as it was for so many people from the colonized world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know that the Second World War is unique in that regard, because it seems to me that wherever African Americans have sought to leverage their citizenship against their military service, we find that pattern. And, you know, I mean, Du Bois in his editorial for The Crisis in World War One, you know, I mean, he's sitting in Versailles after the war because he thinks that there's something about that military service that's going to guarantee the acquisition of a kind of higher, better version of a US citizenship, which is not kind of color-coded. And he, you know, very rapidly comes to see the limitations of that. I mean, think of Korea also, because, you know, I think I'm right in saying that the US military blood supplies were only desegregated during the Korean War. They were still letting white soldiers die in World War II because they weren't going to put black plasma and platelets into their bodies when they were wounded. Spency Love, I think, has written about that in her in the book about the history of the blood banks and so on, and racial segregation. So I think, for me, I think that the shift really comes with Korea, but it is in this process, it is in this time, and of course there is so much to be said about Vietnam and the moment. Self-consciously, you know, as we're told by, you know, in Bloods and other the extraordinary oral history of African American service in Vietnam, where, you know, thrashing through the vegetation, you come to a sign written in English and says, "What the fuck are you doing here? You know, we don't have any quarrel with you. You know, go home and get out of this, because it's not your fight." You know. So I think I'd want to stretch that. I think I can't blame Gardner Smith for seeing World War II in this.
It was his war, after all.
Because he'd served in the U.S. military, and he'd found himself in Berlin as an occupying soldier, although not, of course, as a combatant. So I think there's a larger conversation to be had about the attempts to leverage military service against, or leverage citizenship against military service, and of course that's still a question.
What we can't forget too is the experience of coming home and returning to anti-black race riots and massacres, violence.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is that's the point that's made by the Nazis who've come back to Berlin, who've been in prison camps in North Carolina and places like that. You know, I think Jesse Jackson's father also, in Jesse's telling of it, narrates the same kind of problem. You know, you African-American soldier were guarding us when we were prisoners of war, and we could walk in and get a glass of water, and you couldn't. So what's the nature of this war that you're betting will win you the citizenship you've been denied?
Well, Tyler Stovall, wonderful historian who wrote Paris Noir about Black Americans in Paris, and who also wrote about the Stone Face, has just published a book called White Freedom, which I think speaks to some of these knotty issues that you've just mentioned. And, you know, it's been a real pleasure talking to you about this novel, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Adam, and thank you for all the work that you've done to bring this, you know, this novel, this important if incomplete novel, back into discussion, because I think there's so much to be gained from having a rigorous and a deep conversation about it today in the 21st century.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.